and establish a hearing on Senate Bill 326. And I'll ask staff to give us a little rundown on the bill, or do you want to just let the informational people do it?
I think let's do the informational meeting first.
All right.
Just wait. Give us a little more time.
You don't mind doing that in the stage of a public hearing, do you?
Sure, you can do a public hearing on that.
Then I'll invite Ed Patterson, and I believe he possibly has somebody else he wishes to have accompany him, so let's get the show on the road. On the rural highway, not the road.
The old dirt highway.
Yeah, there you go. Washboard two-run gravel road.
The new toll road, please.
Got an idea there somewhere. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. We appreciate here on Rural Oregon Day to be able to testify on a bill that's very important to rural Oregon, especially rural health in Oregon. For the record, my name is Ed Patterson. I'm representing the Oregon Rural Health Association. The testimony being passed out to you consists of several items that I want to walk through briefly and then turn the meeting over to Don Nyberg, who was a healthcare architect. Don has worked with the state of Oregon for 25 years or so in health planning, a vast amount of experience. Retired fairly recently, so we brought him back into the workforce for a little while to do this study for us. We'll point out to you the Rural Health Association, if you look at the bottom half of that cover letter, it shows the founding members of the Rural Health Association, represents all organizations, health care organizations in the state that all of you are probably familiar with or have run across at some point in your careers. Mr. Chair, in the summer of 2000, you and then Representative Morissette, now Senator Morissette, made a little tour of Eastern Oregon and some of the rural parts of the coast. And what we have here is part of what you discovered on that tour that you took a couple summers ago. Actually, that trip, you'll recall the testimony you heard from many of the hospitals that you visited indicated that the hospitals were getting very ancient. They were built with Federal Hill Burton money back in the 1950s and late 40s. And were 50, 60 years old, and they just did not have access to capital to improve their facilities. They had outlived their usefulness in the present configuration. Methods of delivery of service have changed. We've gone more to outpatients now and throughout the entire healthcare system and less inpatients. And there simply was not the ability to finance new construction for those hospitals. So one of the things you heard in that tour is that in the old days, in the 40s and 50s, when hospitals were built with Federal Hill Burton money, there was grant money and there was low-interest loan money provided to build hospitals in this country, and that's the only way that those rural hospitals were funded. And that went out of circulation. The Congress closed that down in the, I think, early 70s, maybe late 60s. So since that time, there really isn't a source of funds for providing that kind of a infrastructure rebuilding, renovation, replacement. So House Bill 2515 was introduced by Representative Cruz with a number of co-sponsors on it to see what we could do in terms of providing funding for a state-like Hill Burton fund to assist these hospitals in providing that new construction costs. The bill passed ultimately in the 2001 session with funding of $15 million to assist the Oregon Rural Health Association in providing some type of assistance to these rural hospitals that had been deteriorating. Through the course of the interim, the bill in the second special session was that funds were reduced by half, so there was only $7.5 million in the special session. And then in the fifth special session, although we attempted to get the $7.5 million released to accomplish the purpose for which it was enacted, we were unsuccessful, and the governor froze those funds and wouldn't release them. And then when the fifth special session rolled around, the funds again were halved, and there currently is $3.75 million that is unallocated. Or it's allocated, but it's unreleased and still in Department of Administrative Services. So Undaunted, our association pressed on to begin at least the process of evaluating those rural hospitals in the state. And what we did is to recruit Mr. Nyberg to do an architectural assessment study on hospitals who were interested in doing that. So we contacted all of the 31 rural hospitals in the state. All the 31 hospitals in the state to test our interest. Some of those hospitals had the resources to go ahead and update their facilities and didn't have an interest in it. But a number of hospitals responded to us that they would like to have this architectural assessment completed for their facility. So that's when we contacted Mr. Nyberg with all of his vast experience, and he knew almost every rural hospital in the state because he'd been there in the capacity of his employment with the state of Oregon as an architect, a health planning architect. So we finally decided that we applied for a grant from the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, received a $60,000 grant from that organization, and recruited Mr. Nyberg to come out of retirement to perform an assessment of these hospitals and determine what their needs were and what kind of condition they are. We determined we had enough money to accomplish that assessment for 12 hospitals in the state. We selected what we thought were probably the most needy, based on our knowledge and based on their applications, and asked Don to go ahead and begin the assessment process. What you see attached to this testimony is the results of three of those surveys that were accomplished. He's actually completed 10 surveys, but there's only 8 that have put in final form. And I asked him to prepare a summary of his findings and asked him to be here and present to you his assessment. He probably has the best sense of what the condition of those hospitals are of anybody in the state at this point. These have all been done within the last 3 or 4 months. And given his background, I think you'll find his findings of interest. On the last page, you'll see a little matrix we put together that shows all the 8 hospitals and what his findings were and what his recommendations were for those 8 hospitals. I'd like for him to explain to you, of course, the methodology that he used, and perhaps if you have any questions, you might ask him how he made his determinations. So with that, Don, would you go ahead and make your presentation?
Thanks, Ed. Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, I'd first like to provide some explanation of the basis that was used for the review, which applied equally to all the hospitals. I used the standards from the Health Services Division for new construction and alteration of hospitals, which is a standard not mandated for pre-existing facilities, but it provides us a good measurement standard to measure relative modernization need of these hospitals with lower levels of compliance, meaning a higher need for modernization. And also I utilized, to some extent, National Fire Protection Association codes for construction and NFPA 99 for medical gas and vacuum systems and emergency power systems in hospitals. And also ADA requirements. And then as I went through some of the departments, other codes such as food sanitation rules of our health services division as they apply to those kitchen facilities and so on were used. Interestingly enough, the first major category of review under structural and fire and life safety, there were none of the hospitals that were found to be totally of the wrong construction type. They were all generally complying. There were some safety violations which had been identified by the Office of State Fire Marshal and the Joint Commission on Accreditation in their various reviews, and I relied heavily on those, not doing a complete review on my own. To tell you the truth, most of those deficiencies are currently being corrected, and so this was not the major area of problem. I did know meaningful seismic analysis of these structures, and I'm frankly not qualified to do that. But I did note details of the buildings in terms of numbers of stories and so on, and the seismic zone in which these hospitals are located. And interestingly, some of the older hospitals are down in the southern Oregon coast and central coast area, which is fire or seismic zone four, the area of highest risk. I also did a cursory review of mechanical and electrical systems, including heating, ventilating, and air conditioning, medical gas and vacuum, normal and emergency power systems, nurse call and communication systems, and so on. And this was an area found to most commonly be deficient, even in terms of meeting some of the minimum licensing rules. Ventilation and air conditioning in the hospital and air filtration is very important for infection control as well as for the comfort of the patients. And, of course, emergency power is a vital thing in case there's any interruption of the normal power supply. Only two of the hospitals reviewed of the 10 so far had no major problems in this area. The types of problems that tended to exist were air distribution, filtration, air pressure relationships. For example, one of the hospitals had a supply air in a dirty utility room and no return or exhaust, so it means you're pushing the air from the soiled room into the sterile part of the surgery, the opposite from what should exist. Corroded and otherwise failing plumbing lines and valves. One of the most common problems, as you can imagine, with a number of these buildings being over 50 years in age. Asbestos insulation, inadequate electrical distribution, primarily lack of outlets in patient rooms, adequate number. The emergency power system in several of the hospitals was not complying in that it's not broken down into critical life safety and equipment branches as required by the code, which would help reduce the risk of a total failure of some sort. Medical gas and vacuum systems varied substantially, but a number of those are non-compliant, one being soldered with all lead-based solder, which has not been allowed for some time and won't test out and can't be certified. I did a cursory review for ADA requirements, and eight of the 10 hospitals have major problems in that area. I think all of the hospitals have made an honest attempt at compliance with accessible parking and access to the buildings and so on, but with many of these buildings being 1950s and prior to ADA requirements, it's very difficult to bring them into full compliance. I did a rather extensive review of the inpatient care units of these hospitals, again using the Health Services Division standards. And they tended to average about 70% compliance for patient rooms and about 70% for the other features of these nursing floors, like nurses' stations, utility rooms, medication areas, and so on. But amongst that, considerable difference, with one hospital only scoring 45% and 50% compliance, respectively, another 51% and 42%, and a third only 50% and 38%. So in those hospitals in particular, I felt it really showed some high modernization needs. Another problem found in some of the hospitals, I believe four, the arrangement of the hospital was such that they can't work from one nurse's station. And in each case, OB was completely separate from the medical and surgical part of the hospital, so that if they have one mother and one infant in the hospital, they have to staff that department around the clock for that limited number of patients. Very inefficient and difficult for them to do anything about given their current physical arrangement. I did a review of major departmental areas, lab, radiology, emergency, and so on, as well as some of the departments that are not directly patient-related, like laundry and dietary and central sterile supply and administrative and public areas. And of those, they came out with an average rating of around 68%. Again, you know, a lot of variation depending on the hospital and the department. Of all the hospitals reviewed, I would say that approximately five of them really need replacement. Three to four of these would need replacement on another site, because of limited property being available, and in some cases the topography limiting the potential for expansion. The others may get by with some sort of phased replacement on site, and may in fact be able to utilize some of their newer building wings, which would help. One of the issues that really became apparent was that there's really a need for good long-range development planning in many of these hospitals. They've tended to add to an older building core with various additions, but the central part of the hospital still being required. And what you're doing is kind of building new construction, but limiting the life of those new building wings to the potential lifespan of the old core original building, which in many cases is 50 years old. So, and I think that's not been by virtue necessarily of bad planning on behalf of the hospitals. It reflects, I think, limited funds available and trying to meet pressing needs at the time. One of the hospitals I reviewed, I thought, had done an excellent job of a master plan that was going to allow them to do a phased replacement on site and limit the cost. Does anyone have any questions?
Yes, Senator Morset.
Thank you, Mr. Nyberg. Having visited some of the hospitals that you're talking about, no doubt, and looking at the configuration and listening to the concerns of the staff in terms of inadequacy in movement, and you've touched on all of that, I guess, how common is this throughout the United States? I mean, the Hill-Burton funds, that was a federal program that did fund these hospitals during this time period. I imagine that there were many, many rural hospitals then built that time. Is this a fairly extensive common problem throughout the country?
Well, I'm not all that familiar with hospitals in other states, but I believe it to be so.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess what I'm... You know, there are various failing systems that were put in place years ago, including wastewater systems that were put in during the 70s and 80s that are starting to reach that point. And I don't know where that $3.7 million is and where it's going to be, but by the time we get through with this process. So there is a crisis, and I know that some hospitals have a hospital zone. Now, are some of them...
Tax district.
Mm-hmm. May I continue this line of question?
Sure.
Have some of them then used the local taxing district then to do the necessary rebuilding and repairs and all that? Is that the way many of them are doing it now?
I believe some of them have gone to the taxpayers to assist in some of that construction because they've been unable to, you know, do it on their own
revenue. One of the strategies that I think we need to be looking at is not, you know, if this is a problem that exists throughout the western states anyway, I don't know about the eastern, more populated areas, urging Congress to take a look at this and helping to provide some funds. I know... the alternative is, well, I was thinking while you were speaking, I was waiting for you to say that some of these hospitals were out of compliance totally, but none of them are. They're all within the legal range, right, of their various states of disrepair?
Well, I really can't say that to be true, because I did find violations that would not be in compliance with even minimum standards.
Okay, so there's an outside chance, or maybe an inside chance, that some of these hospitals might just be shut down for various reasons. I could see a healthcare problem if you have an unhealthy hospital. I mean, if you have a sick building, mm-hmm. the hospital is not the place to have it, and if they're the air exchange system. So I guess my concern is that if we do nothing, we may lose rural hospitals. We may simply lose them.
Well, it's certainly going to be difficult for some of them.
What we can do is the other question. I'm not quite sure what the state has to do this. And, you know, it was nice that there was originally a $21 million amount that was cut in half and down to 7.5 and now down to 3.7.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I'd be best one to respond to that, because we, of course... found exactly what most of us that have been around the healthcare industry in rural hospitals, we knew we would find. But no one had quantified what how much those hospitals have need. So Don began the process of doing that, and we began the process of doing that without receiving any of the funds that were intended to do that.
Right.
And these are, you know, the $60,000 was a limited amount, but what really needs to be done is these hospitals that can't afford it need to have some master planning done so they know where they're going to go and get a long-range plan completed. Unfortunately, many of these hospitals are marginal operations. Most of them have never funded depreciation, so there's no build-up resources for replacement monies. And the very next thing that needs to be done is a financial assessment for the hospitals we deem are the most critical in nature that indeed will close down in the next few years, because a hospital 50 years old, and I know you folks have heard all the crises in the world are happening right here in Oregon. And this is one more of them that we want to make you aware of. If we had that money, that is left, that is still there and not been appropriated, we would begin the process of hiring the expertise to develop these master plans on behalf of the hospital to do the financial analysis, much the same as the architectural analysis does, and to help these folks find some money. Now that, you know, some of those planning studies cost a lot of money in terms of a couple $100,000 that a small hospital in most cases do not have that kind of cash. That's why they've done the willy-nilly improvements to meet their needs. So I guess what we would look at as a rural health association is we would begin to help those hospitals that we now have identified as probably having the most serious needs, the ones that are most apt to have a real crisis on their hands, either from a humanitarian standpoint with the kinds of things that Don has found, or from just inability to access capital, and that's what it really is. And the next thing we would do would be to help those folks find the access to the capital. We currently have been looking at some potential government low-interest loans to do this, some rural development loan money. And I think probably there are some available, but most of them require some type of matching funds. And that's the most difficult part that you have in terms of working with this type of client that really have no money themselves.
Yes, Senator Brown.
And sorry to be late. I had a leadership meeting that took a little longer than we anticipated. What about economic development dollars? I assume some of these hospitals, at least the one I'm familiar with, and Enterprise, is somewhat critical to the economy of the local area. Is there any possibility of accessing economic development dollars?
Senator Brown, I think there probably is, and quite frankly, we have not had the resource to look at all the potential. The money that we're talking about was the famous or infamous MUPPA funds, mm-hmm. that the original $20,000 or $20 million that we were told we would get didn't materialize. So not general fund money. I know. But we did not seek other funds than the MUPPA funds, but potentially there are economic development funds for this purpose.
I had a question from the architect here. It's my understanding that pretty much a major remodeling requires all the rest of the mechanical and electrical parts be brought up to code.
Actually, the health services requirements are such that there isn't any magic number where you do 20% of equivalent replacement cost and you have to bring the whole building up to standard. It's anything you do has to meet the newer requirements. There isn't any point where you're required to bring it all up or all of a particular wing of a building up to those standards.
Even in a major remodeling?
All of the major remodeling they do has to meet the requirements, but as far as that remodel goes. And
so you're not being unduly restricted by some of those things and spending wads of money getting other parts of the hospital?
No, I don't believe so. And those regulations have had a great deal of input by the industry. And in fact, they were a partner in helping write them. So, I don't think they would do that to themselves.
Well, I don't think that the homeowners wanted to do that to themselves either. I think they got that gratis.
Further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your time.
This actually was just a short rendition of what we heard at every hospital and clinic stop on our rural tour.
Yeah. Well, I ask just to
go ahead.
Be sure I understand. Now, as far as you know, that there is $3.7 million that is currently being held by the E-Board, is that? Tell me.
Senator Morissette, the money was allocated to Department of Administrative Services.
Oh, Administrative Services. Okay. And they have the money.
Because there was no date specific in the okay. statute okay. about when it was to be paid, the governor froze the funds for obvious reasons.
Okay. Okay. That money
that's where the money is now.
In a vault. I know. I know. I know what it's going to be used for. Don't tell him, though.
I knew it was gone. I didn't know it was going to last. Mr. Chair, just let me leave this with you. This is an article on Oregon Business Magazine. It's about a little over a year old now. But for those of you who would like to learn more about the problems, things that you folks learned on the trip, this is an excellent article and fairly accurately tells the problems that rural hospitals have, rural health centers have, rural health clinics, and just the health delivery system in rural Oregon. And if we didn't convince you that the potential for a real crisis exists, I think this article might help. So I'd like to leave this with you.
Thank you.
May I ask? Thank you. Senator Smith now is, I hear in the paper today or in the news this morning that he's the chair of the subcommittee on health care and so on. And I know that when we took our trip, that his name came up quite often in terms of, now, are we talking to our congressional delegation, again, going back to federal dollars, are we doing that?
We have not made that direct approach.
Okay, I really hope that we talk to our rural representatives, Senator Wyden, Senator Smith, and Representative Walden, particularly, well, DeFazio, and really make that point, is that we need, you know, this is a federal issue. It's a national issue, and I'm sure it exists in other states, and this is what rural Oregon is all about, rural living. And without hospitals and schools, economic development is almost impossible. People will not move to a community unless they have those essentials. And I think we have to make that point, not only statewide, but nationally. And so money has to be put into that. So the reauthorization of Hill-Burton would be great, right?
Or something like that.
We'll call it something different. We'll call it the Smith...
Smith-Wyden.
Yeah, the Smith-Wyden or the Smith-Walden or something like that. We'll. Thank you.
Couldn't agree with you more. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd ask Karen Whitaker and Paul McGinnis.
What?
Yeah, really good thing yesterday.
Oh, and Ed's coming back on this?
A demonstration.
All right.
Are we back on 3.6?
No. Well, Howard did, I thought. I started it off, that's why I was asking the funny.
Okay.
To keep our record straight, I'll again make known this is a public hearing on Senate Bill 326.
Yeah. I can get Paul to pass those out over there. You get those to her.
But it was a good one.
Go right ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ed Patterson. I'm again representing the Oregon Rural Health Association, and we're passing out my prepared testimony. Senate Bill 326 is again an attempt to deal with some of the issues of rural health. We have in Oregon 31 certified, federally certified rural health clinics. And that title is important because there are other types of clinics in the state. So this bill specifically identifies the need in these 31 rural health clinics. And you can see in the text of my testimony, it spells out that this is a federally designated type clinic. And it tries to explain, you'll see in the second page of the testimony, there's a map. There's a map of where all these clinics are located in the state. And also attached to that is the titles of the clinics and the address of the clinics. The Rural Health Association did a study in the latter part of December of 2001 identifying some of the problems in the rural health clinics, and that study is available for anyone who cares to look at it. But it did, again, spell out that, that these rural areas are having a tough time providing access to health care for the people who live in rural Oregon. Rural health clinics normally are very small operations, sometimes one, two, or three individual practitioners. They're usually located at least 30 miles from the next closest health care provider, and they provide needed services by primarily nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, and sometimes physicians themselves because they're required to have at least a consulting physician on staff. Our survey indicated that these clinics, much like the rural hospitals we've talked about, have a very high percentage of Medicaid patients and a very high percentage of Medicare patients and a very high percentage of charity cases. So it's extremely difficult financially for these clinics to operate. Up until about, well, right after the advent of the Oregon Health Plan in 1994, the Medicaid reimbursement to these clinics was reduced to less than their cost for providing the service. So they went through a very long, struggling time, and some of the clinics fell by the wayside. Some have since cropped up again because the feds 2 years ago passed a law that said states must reimburse Medicaid rural health clinics at the cost of providing the service to the for Medicaid. So that helps some of these clinics survive. And of course, depending on what happens this session, they could take another hit when we lose a number of qualified Oregon Health Plan patients, so we expect to see another downturn in that. So they are struggling providing a needed service. And our Rural Health Association study pointed that out. Subsequent to the Rural Health Association study, there was a study done by the Oregon Primary Care Association. They did an extensive study about the financial problems that these clinics were dealing with. And what they determined that on average, the study showed that on average, every one of these clinics is losing $70,000 a year. Well, obviously, you can't continue to do that. The study was done in, I think, 2001 also, right, before the Medicaid reimbursement enhancement. Yeah. So there have been some improvements there, but it's the most recent study that's been done. So there are another set of clinics in the state called federally qualified clinics, and they are a different breed of cat. Most of them are located in the larger areas, population areas of the state, and they are subsidized by the federal government in terms of their operating subsidies. Some of those clinics receive as much as $500,000 a year to subsidize their operations because they see the same type of clients, patients. But in order to keep their doors open, they have to have some operating subsidy. So one of the things that our study showed that if we had some funds to subsidize the operations of these rural health clinics, then they too could keep their doors open and serve the type of patients that need to receive the service from someplace. The average of that is would tally up on average $75,000 a year would require a $5 million appropriation for the biennium. And so our bill spells out that the $5 million appropriation is requested. The bill also spells out that these are economically important to the rural areas and that this money should come from lottery economic development funds. And it so states in the bill. Paul McGinnis is here, and he's done an awful lot of work. He's with the Office of Rural Health. He's done a lot of work with these rural clinics, understands their operation, their needs. And I asked him to present some testimony on behalf of the clinics and their financial requirements. Paul?
Mr. Chair, I have separate testimony from that which was presented by Mr. Patterson. My name is Paul McGinnis, and I'm the Director of Field Services for the Office of Rural Health and This next month starts my 20th year of providing technical assistance to rural Oregon health providers. And today I'm representing the people who are sitting behind me, people from Spray, Morrow, M-O-R-O, Fossil, Condon, and Jordan Valley. These are communities with 8-man football teams and quite a distance between themselves and the next level of care. Over the 20 years that I've served these folks, rural clinics have been and continue to be a major part of that community's infrastructure. The clinics are vital to the economy of these small underserved communities, and simply their presence helps attract and retain people and businesses. People will not stay if they can't get health care services. They provide jobs to educated folks and providers. Those providers create jobs for support staff in the clinics. These clinics purchase other goods and services from other businesses, keeping the power flowing, office supplies, other issues. They recapture for that community health expenditures that have already been committed by the public. We have to remember that basically our health care expenditures are spent. We send the money to Salem for Medicaid, to Rockville for Medicare, or to a third-party payer. We send our premiums out, and it's only where you consume the services that that health care expenditure is recaptured. So without the existence of the clinic, they have no ability to recapture any of the money that they've already spent on health care. And they serve as forward and backward linkages to other health providers. Without the clinic in Jordan Valley, there is no doctor that comes and visits every 2 weeks. There is no dental service in the other half of the clinic. There is no relationship between the pharmacy that exists in Condon if there isn't a clinic in Condon. So the public health, the forward linkages and the backward linkages, when those people are discharged from a hospital and go back to these communities, there is a connection, and without that presence, there is no economic ability for those communities to survive. They are also part of the social fabric of those rural communities, and they provide access, and it's really more an issue of availability rather than accessibility for those people who have trouble traveling long distances. They generally serve everybody in the community regardless of ability to pay. These clinics often do and assist in health promotion and education activities through screenings. But I think most of all, they provide a social value in the peace of mind that comes for the people who sit behind me in knowing that there is a professional health care provider within reach. This bill is intended to support certified rural health clinics, and that's what your amendment dealt with, and I think that's an important amendment. Because certified rural health clinics are by definition located in a rural area and are underserved. If you're not one of those two things, you can't qualify to be a federally certified rural health clinic. Now, this certification allows for a capped payment for Medicare at about $64 per encounter and 100% of reasonable cost for Medicaid, which is just being implemented now. But despite these favorable government reimbursement strategies, when you look at the condition of the clinics, 10 of the 17 that reported financial information, and I should say that Mr. Patterson mentioned there were 30-some, these clinics aren't required to reveal their financial status. But 10 of the 17 that did provide information had negative operating margins, from a negative 3.7% to a negative 149.4% in the fiscal year 99 to 2000. We're talking a great deal of gap there. And there are generally three sources of money for these non-operating revenues that these clinics have done. First has been safety net funds, which the legislature appropriated in 98 and 99. The second is grants from foundations, which several of our community clinics have survived on over a number of years. And the third is that they form local health districts and tax themselves to first a constant supply of dollars for non-operating. And in Oregon, we have 12 of those that support rural clinics, and the people behind me represent a lot of those, and they bring local property dollars of about $851,000 a year so that they have a clinic in their community and support those. I looked at the potential for areas in the state for rural health clinics, and I think there are about 33 potential areas that would qualify for this. 8 of those 33 have less than 2,000 people. 22 of those 33 potential areas have less than 5,000 people. And remember, in healthcare services, it's the number of people that you have in an area that generate the demand for your service. There's 860-some people in Jordan Valley in southern Malheur County. That clinic can't make people more sick so that they can use the services at a greater level. You know, you're basically going to go to a doctor 3 times a year on average. That's only 1,800 visits. If everybody in that community got sick at the rate that's normal and all of them went to a clinic in Jordan Valley, they still wouldn't generate enough revenue to remain open. So, but at the same time, they're 60-something miles away from the next available health care. And without a clinic in Jordan Valley, there isn't anything from Ontario to Fort McDermott, Nevada. And that's a long stretch of U.S. 95 without any health care services. But of those 30 service areas that I mentioned, 33, on average, they would be about 28.7 miles from the next hospital. And 10 of those are over 40, with the longest being 103 miles to the hospital. They're experiencing slower growth than the state as a whole. 6 of those service areas actually lost population since 1990. 24 of those service areas, we're talking about clinics that are the only provider in the community, the only one there. It's not as if you have competing businesses, say, in some of the communities where if one goes out of business, you still have another provider in place. In 24 of those 33, they're the only game in town. These clinics also serve, and Mr. Patterson showed you a map. I brought you one with some color on the back. And we have levels of underservice in Oregon that compare each of these service areas to one another in Oregon as opposed to federal comparisons. If you're in a tan or a brown area, that means you're more underserved. And you can see the correlation between the darker, the tan or brown area, and the little red cross, which represents the presence of a rural health clinic. They're mostly in areas of underservice. I urge you to support and pass Senate Bill 326. It's a viable strategy for these communities economically, and the money would be well used as an investment in rural Oregon.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Karen Whitaker, and I'm the director of the Office of Rural Health. We're very fortunate to have Paul McGinnis working in our office. He's very modest, but he is a nationally recognized expert on rural community development, and he and his staff traveled 45,000 miles last year in rural Oregon, just providing technical assistance to rural clinics. And I basically wanted to just outline the work that we do with rural clinics so that you could see the type of help that is suggested in the bill, the technical assistance. We have 3 positions in our office that are full-time field positions. One of them is not filled because of budget problems. So Paul and he has one other person who works with him, and they're on the road most of the time. Many of these clinics are so small that they simply don't have the resources available to do adequate billing, to revamp their information systems, or even think about providing information systems. Some of them don't even have computerized billing available to them. And so that's the type of thing that our office is able to provide for them. Senator Morissette, I wanted to comment on the federal level. You asked a question about what kind of federal help is available. There is some federal help available for rural clinics and rural hospitals. And the Critical Access Hospital Program that we've talked about in other settings is one of those, provides Medicare, cost-based Medicare reimbursement. We also had a Small Hospital Improvement Act that passed Congress last session that gave money to state offices of rural health to distribute to small hospitals. We were able to distribute $7,752 to each rural hospital, not enough to even think about any capital improvement, but I thought you'd want to be filled in on that. So that's really the content of my remarks. I thought I'd be here to answer questions for you regarding our office if you had any. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll ask Gene Birch and Greg here. Yeah. And Representative Greg Smith.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
Days going by. Would you like me to begin?
How you wish. Go ahead.
How if I begin? Would that be all right?
That'd be fine. Thank you.
We'll get you back to whatever you were doing as quick as we can.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Greg Smith, representing District 57, which includes Wallowa, Union, Morrow, and parts. I say the best parts of Umatilla County. It's truly an honor to be here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 326. This is an issue that's become near and dear to me. My background is economic development, and what I do in Eastern Oregon professionally is I work hard to help create jobs in rural Oregon, create infrastructure, and try and create sustainable communities that folks are proud of. And part of my work started about 18 months ago when I was doing some work in Wheeler County, and I was working with the judge, and she said, you know, Greg, one of the issues we're really struggling with is health care, rural health care. And I reflected back to when I was in the legislature last session, and, you know, we talked about health care. But it never really hit me how important it is for these small rural communities to have clinics that are open and viable until I had a chance to go in and see what was going on in the Asher Clinic in Fossil. And it convinced me, we in Oregon have a problem. We spend so much of our time talking about economic development and creating new infrastructure and creating new jobs, while at the same time we turn our back on our existing infrastructure and our existing jobs. And I would tell you, not only as a representative, but as a professional in economic development, that if you want to develop rural Oregon, if you want to create jobs in rural Oregon, if you want to sustain jobs in rural Oregon, this is the first step, and that's having good, viable health care. The options out there are pretty darn limited. When folks come out to our neck of the woods and they think about locating a company there, the first question they ask is, where's the doctor? And then they ask, where's the school? And we're working on the school issue. But I'll tell you what, if we turn our back on these clinics, I think we're going to have a heck of a time developing jobs in the future. I'm pleased that Mr. Patterson has brought this legislation forward. I think Senator Nelson has truly, truly taken a leadership role in sponsoring this legislation. And Chair Fisher, I truly appreciate you bringing this forward. Again, let me reiterate, if we want to create jobs in Eastern Oregon, if we want to sustain our infrastructure in Eastern Oregon, this is a good first step. It's a vital first step. And so with that, I do say thank you as well to Karen Whitaker and her hard work of her and her staff, and thank you very much for having me here today.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Judge Jean Birch from Wheeler County. I reside in Fossil, Oregon. We are the rural of the ruralist, or the ruralist of the rural. But the health care is vital to our area. If we didn't have our clinic in our county seat, our citizens could possibly drive round trip 200 miles for medical care. And sometimes this is over very icy, windy roads. During the summer months, we have a preponderance of visitors to our area with the John Day River. And because of that, our clinic serves lots of people that are not from Wheeler County. And I guarantee you, every year, there are a lot of people that get in trouble out there and in one way or another. From an economic development standpoint, it's absolutely critical that we keep these jobs there. There's 17 in Asher Clinic. There's 17 across the street in Haven House. That's 34 jobs in our county. And my colleague from Harding County, Steve Grasky, uses the example of 144 jobs in Portland equal one in Harney County. Well, I don't even know what that would work for in Wheeler County, but I did a little quick calculation. That's 4,000 jobs. That makes a lot of difference, doesn't it? It would be nice to create 17 more jobs in Wheeler County this year, but we're not going to do it without health care. I urge you to consider this base funding. We're not asking for lots and lots of money, but we need to keep those doors open. And I really thank you for the opportunity to hear our story.
You're welcome. Senator Morrison.
Do you have a nursing home there too?
Yes, we do. Yeah. Well, it's not a nursing home. It's sort of between retirement and assisted living, but we do have assisted living with full care 20 miles away from us in Condon. And we think of ourselves as regional. You know, 20 miles might be a long way here in the city, but it's you know, just a hop next door.
Well, the reason I'm asking that question is we had a resident of Springfield who passed away recently, and I think he was in the nursing home in Fossil.
Oh, it could be.
Bowerman?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, of course.
Okay,
and Mrs. Bowerman
is there should be a Nike connection there. And if you haven't made that connection yet, Greg, you need to get on that.
Mrs. Bowerman still lives there, Barbara Bowerman, and she's been very generous with her connection to that and the Oregon Community Foundation. But unfortunately, you know, she can only do so much.
I understand
but she is a great supporter of Haven House and of our clinic.
Mm-hmm. I just want to add that Bill Bowerman was a friend of mine, and he actually, the Nike company actually started in Springfield in a chemistry lab at the Booth Kelly site or whatever. And I was interested that he did go back to his roots, and apparently he was born there, right?
Very near Bryan.
Yeah, and they have, it's a, yeah, he's a great person, and he was, and his wife is a very nice lady, so good.
And we were pleased that she saw how wonderful it was to stay, because after Bill passed away, mm-hmm. you know, she could have easily picked up and gone back to Eugene, and she wants to stay out where we are. Oh, excuse me. I stand corrected.
And they're only 3 miles apart.
Okay.
We're miles and miles apart.
Senator Clinton.
Thank you. I just wanted to say it's nice to have somebody from Fossil here. We just don't often have somebody from Fossil. And as you can see from my last name, my husband's great-great-grandfather homesteaded in Clarno. And you have to go through Clarno to come from Fossil to come over here, unless you went through Condon, of course. And I know that because I lived 23 years in Sherman County. So I just want you to know how much we appreciate it when folks can come from a long distance and testify. And we see on maps, we see, you know, Jordan Valley, where I have relatives and been there a lot. It 44 miles or 66 miles or something looks on a piece of paper like between here and Portland is X many miles. But when you're going on roads that are country roads or roads that there's a lot of winding and draws and canyons and these kind of things. It's a lot more time consuming than a straight stretch between here and Portland, and I just think it's so great that you traveled all the way over here, and we appreciate you very much.
Oh, thank you very much.
When I look at the map here, you have several of these clinics north of you. But it's like you got to the end of the line when you reached Fossil.
I've heard that before.
But I have to let you know that we are the undiscovered, wonderful part of Oregon that some people need to figure out how to get to. But when they do, in the summer with the tourism, then we still have this medical question.
Yeah, if it were not for Christmas Valley, you would literally be the last hope for that whole area of southern Oregon. Yeah, we have Ruby Houghton.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Fisher.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ruby Houghton. I am the Legislative and Public Affairs Director for CARE Oregon. CARE Oregon is a small Oregon business and not-for-profit specializing in managing the care of the Oregon Health Plan population. We were formed to receive the Oregon Health Plan population by a consortium of the Safety Net through the Oregon Primary Care Association, Multnomah County Health Department, and Oregon Health Sciences University. I wanted to lend my support for Senate Bill 326 today, recognizing that I have been a part of the statewide safety net coalition since I started the health safety net coalition, since I started working for CARE Oregon. I've had the pleasure of working with Karen Whitaker and with Paul McGinnis and with people all around our state who are standing in the gap for vulnerable Oregonians. I wanted you to know that there's one caveat to my support for this bill. I need you to recognize that this is a small portion of what is necessary in order to keep Oregon's health care system viable. The health care safety net is not just the federally certified rural clinics. It includes other clinics all around our state. It's a patchwork. And it's absolutely necessary for us to begin to take a look at the fact that our state has 11.3% of Oregonians in metropolitan areas who are uninsured and 12.9% of Oregonians who are uninsured in rural Oregon. This is a piece of the pie, and it's absolutely essential that we begin to look at the full patchwork of the health care safety net and make sure that we are meeting the needs of all Oregonians. I also wanted to make sure that you knew that supporting the Oregon Health Plan is absolutely critical at this particular juncture. Our matching funds for Oregon are, for our 40%, we get 60%. It's a 40-60 match. Those are Oregon dollars coming back from Washington, D.C. to aid in economic development, to improve rural Oregon, to improve hospitals throughout our state, rural hospitals that are in need, as well as the rest of the state. So I want to encourage you as you move along, recognizing that your task is large, your responsibility is huge, and to let you know how much I appreciate the work that you do on behalf of vulnerable Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruby. Questions? Okay, thank you. Have now Bruce Bishop. Bruce, I couldn't find anybody to help you come up here and oppose this bill. I got to looking at that, and I hope you're not going to be the Grinch that steals Christmas Valley.
Ed Patterson.
see if they hadn't changed position.
Thank you, Senator Fischer, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, and I'm appearing this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I'm presenting written testimony on behalf of David Bigelow, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Samaritan Pacific Communities Hospital. Mr. Bigelow called yesterday and indicated that he was unable to attend your hearing this afternoon and asked me to extend his apologies to you for that. I should also note that his written testimony is prepared as if it were the Senate Committee on Health Policy rather than this committee, and I apologize to you for that error. With your permission, Senator Fischer, I will read most of Mr. Bigelow's statement into the record for the committee. For the record, I'm David Bigelow, Chief Executive Officer of Samaritan Pacific Communities Hospital in Newport. I am also a member of the Board of Trustees for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems on the board of the Oregon Rural Health Association. However, as you will soon realize, my testimony today does not represent the views of the Oregon Rural Health Association. Despite my strong personal and professional interests in supporting healthy systems of hospital and clinical care throughout Oregon, particularly in many rural areas, I regret that I cannot support Senate Bill 326. As a rural hospital provider, Samaritan Pacific Communities Hospital is struggling to fulfill its mission of meeting the needs for medical care of our local residents and of visitors to our coastal community. Given our local, state, and national economies and the budget crisis facing Oregon, we are facing the likelihood of severe reductions in the funding available for rural and urban hospital services throughout the state. This is not the environment in which we can afford to authorize a new program to fund rural health clinics. Let me explain the financial realities we're wrestling with today at Samaritan Pacific Communities Hospital. Our 49-bed facility has annual net revenues of approximately $31 million. 60% of these revenues derive from Medicare, and 20% come from Medicaid. Just to interrupt reading Mr. Bigelow's letter, I think it's important to underscore that. 80% of the money that his hospital receives comes from Medicare and Medicaid. To continue, the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, which administers the Oregon Health Plan, is proposing the payments to Oregon hospitals be reduced substantially beginning March 1st. These reductions will have serious financial consequences for our hospital. By the end of June 2005, the proposed reductions will cost us approximately $448,000 because of changes in eligibility and approximately $1.4 million because of the loss of cost-based funding as a rural hospital. This means that starting immediately, we may have to reduce our expenditures by 3%. There are no deep pockets to which I can shift those costs. Even as part of one of Oregon's largest and strongest hospital systems, we cannot just swallow those reductions. Pacific Communities' hit of nearly $2 million is only about one quarter of the cut that will be sustained by Samaritan Health Systems overall. Over $5 million in state Medicaid reductions is also planned for our hospitals in Albany, Corvallis, Lebanon, and Lincoln City. Our system does not have broad enough shoulders to bear these costs without consequences for our patients' health and our community's well-being. This is the reason we cannot support Senate Bill 326's passage. If there is $5 million in state resources that can be used for health services, those funds should be committed to restoring the cuts that are being made in current programs rather than being spent for any new program, whether it's for health care, public safety, or education. There can be no economic benefit in my community if our hospital closes. A rural health clinic will not pick up the slack. Oregon employers will not pay the cost for health care services to low-income Oregonians. Neither the federal government nor the state is going to increase support for their employees' health benefits. But there's another reason that Senate Bill 326 should not be approved. In the Oregon Medicaid program, every dollar the state spends can be matched by $1.50 in federal monies. Senate Bill 326 offers no similar leveraging benefit for the state budget or for local health care providers. It's not fiscally prudent, particularly in today's economic environment, to divert needed funds from Medicaid. More than you can probably appreciate, I wish you could write a blank check that would let us commit some of the state's lottery gains to health services. But if you're going to do that, please direct those monies through Medicaid to stop the financial hemorrhaging that we're already seeing in hospitals and in physician offices throughout Oregon. As expressed in Section 4 of the bill, there is an emergency affecting the public peace, health, and safety. Unfortunately, Senate Bill 326's enactment would not remedy it. I respectfully request that the committee not take favorable action on Senate Bill 326. Thank you.
So you're saying, Bruce, here that we don't get federal match on these monies?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my impression of the way the bill is crafted by spending the money in the Office of Rural Health is that it would not qualify for federal match.
I was not aware of that. It was my assumption that those would be federally matched programs. Do you folks have, yes, come up, Karen, or Ed, both?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our office does attract a considerable amount of federal dollars. And although they would not be Medicaid dollars, we do attract a 3-to-1 federal match from our state offices of rural health grant. Because we're in danger of losing the emergency medical services funds that we've talked with you about in a previous session, we're in danger of losing those matching funds. So we would be able to match these funds 3-to-1 with federal dollars. They wouldn't be Medicaid dollars, but they would be federal dollars.
You know, this is, I guess, just an evidence of the problem that so often it seems like that our government practices and things that we do, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. And if we had some more latitude in using federal funds in the form of block grants rather than in specific programs, it would seem to me that we could do a better job here in deciding where they needed to go possibly than what we do the way it is. It's a tough thing. I do recognize the problems on both sides of the coin here as we go into a time that quite frankly, I had not anticipated yesterday afternoon's briefing from legislative fiscal and coming down here. I am working in close conjunction with the sub-chair of the Human Resources Committee with Ways and Means, and also our Senate Committee co-chair of Ways and Means, and they have requested that I not do a work session on this bill and pass that to them at this time. I am concerned because, frankly, I'm rural to my roots, my background, and know the importance of not only the clinics but the hospitals and any form of ambulance service or anything else that we can get in the outflung rural areas. So it's very frustrating to me to be going into a time when we know we have these things, when other economic pressures are coming to bear unevenly across the state and have been for some 8 to 10 years, and not having the funds to deal with it to at least do what we'd like to in the health care services that we provide. So I don't have all the answers, but we'll continue to work on this and appreciate it. But it would appear that maybe you have even a better remuneration matching rate than what we get here. Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Morrison.
Well, I know what I would suggest, and we're
while you're doing this, Senator Farioli would like to come down. Go ahead.
Well, while he's walking down the aisle, what I suggest is that we pass this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation and send it to Ways and Means and let them make the decision.
Well, I've kind of made an arbitrary decision not to go quite that route. I do not wish to make them be all the brunt of the hard work.
Well, they can sort it out.
They just asked me to hold on to it for a while so they could get things sorted out down there a bit, and so I have no intention of just not doing anything at all with it, but we will hold on to it for the time.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think every single member of this committee knows exactly what we're up against, and I'm not going to belabor the issue or beg the committee. It's just that some of you made the trip to rural Oregon during our medical trip or our sort of a show-me trip to rural Oregon. Since that time, since you made your trip to rural Oregon, I've since visited the Asher Clinic and Jordan Valley Clinic, and those facilities simply are unsustainable. We've gotten ourselves locked into a loop with the expansion of the Oregon Health Plan, and the only way we can expand the Oregon Health Plan is to reduce the amount of reimbursement on services. So it doesn't take you very long in a diminishing returns equation to see that we're in a downward spiral, and the things that seem to crash first are the ones that are farthest away from Salem. If we don't have some mechanism to change that trajectory, those clinics will close. And in Jordan Valley, that means that people are going to go hundreds of miles to the next nearest facility, which in their case is Idaho. And in the Asher Clinic, the folks may have somewhat of a relatively closer alternative in Condon, but it's still one mountain range away, and in certain times of the year, that's difficult for anybody to make, and for seniors it can be difficult any time during the year. I just want to make sure people understand that there's nothing new about the Office of Rural Health or the programs that they administer. It's just that they are feeling the same sort of stress that all of us are feeling relative to these budget issues. And that, and I think you all know, that in rural areas with the health care facilities, there is no depth on the bench. There are no alternatives. Either you got the local health care facility and the clinic is open, and you've got health care services at some level, albeit a relatively low level, or you have nothing. And so that's, I think, why Senate Bill 326 comes to you. When we have looked at the landscape and tried to figure out how we're going to solve the problem of diminishing returns, the only alternative we can come up with is find a different source of funding, to try to keep those services available in the communities. And lottery dollars are a different source of funding. In fact, they are not leveraged dollars through Medicaid. They leverage at a higher level through the rural health clinics. You just heard it here. So I hope you look at this bill, hold it as long as you need to. It just needs to be considered in the mix of the essential health, peace, and safety services that we provide for communities. And I know you're up against it just like everybody else is. I know every member of the committee feels under the same obligation to provide the best services we possibly can for health care. I just would remind you that in the frontier areas of the state of Oregon, it's less resilient, harder to provide services, and greater distances to get to the clinics, and I hope you'll help me keep them open. Thank you.
Would you, since Representative Smith gave us a rundown of the counties he represents, would you mind naming your short list?
I would, Mr. Chairman. It's everything else. Everything you don't represent, I do. I've got 11 counties east of the Cascades, and it starts over in Clackamas. I have a sliver of Clackamas at the top of the Great Divide there, encompassing some of the Warm Springs Indian Reservation, and a little of Marion County. I'm trying to keep the Marion County one secret because otherwise I just get a lot of mail, a lot of visits from folks from Marion County. And they have wonderful representation here in the building. And then I have all of Wasco County, which is an expansion. I used to represent only half of Wasco County. Got it all now. I have all of Jefferson County, which is new to the district from redistricting, which is Madras and most of the Warm Springs Indian Reservation. I have a sliver of Deschutes County, which also is encompassed in the Warm Springs Reservation. All of Wheeler County, Gillam County, Sherman County, have all of Grant County, have all of Harney County, and all of Malheur County, and all of Baker County. And gosh, I hope I haven't left anybody out there. It's all or part of 11 counties encompassing 34,000 square miles. Arguably the most rural district in America. Certainly it has the lowest population density of any place in Oregon. It's frontier by federal definition. It's a place where you can stand on Wednesday and see both Sundays most of the time.
But I can see you have the vested interest in this if you have any kind of an accident anywhere out there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the issue for us is the two questions that we regularly get asked are, how good are your schools? And what's the health care like in your community? You know, we have to, for the last 6 or 7 years, we've had to tell them, well, we're on a 4-day school week. You know, we've been there for a long time. But our kids tend to test better and read as well as or better and cipher as well as or better than any of the kids in the state of Oregon. So our schools turn out pretty good kids. The schools tend to be the only activity in the community. So it's very kid-centered and very school-oriented in many of our communities. But the healthcare system is a constant wrangle because our citizens are older by decades on average than the citizens in the general population. So an older population, more geriatric service needs, and all the issues like transportation and for seniors and all the community services that are geared to seniors are heavily used, and the local clinics are really important.
So you've got a 4-day school and a circuit riding doctor.
Yeah, and in Jordan Valley, the guy comes from Idaho to practice.
Senator Morrison.
Yes. I will not let this go quietly in the night. I think we ought to pass this. I think we refer to ways and means, because I am totally, totally convinced that we will end up with two Oregons, two distinct Oregons, the have-not Oregon, where there are no schools and no hospitals, and people will leave there in droves, and we will have the I-5 corridor Oregon. I think this is, I guess, maybe even next to the medically needy program, this is a very, very high on my list of priorities. I grew up in a rural area. I it's just vital. And I know I own school district, I think, was probably the highest in the state in terms of test scores. And I just think that it's essential that we do this. Now, whether or not we pass this out today, I think it is critical that we pass this bill, because it is a life or death issue. The nursing homes will close. Where will people go when they close the nursing home, and which are connected to the hospitals and clinics? You know, there are so many ramifications involved in this. It's an economic development issue, and I think it should come under the auspices of economic development. I mean, that, you know, if we can find economic development money to fund this, we need to. And we need to get the federal dollars, increase federal dollars. But this, to me, is very important. So I hope that we, if we don't do it today, that we do it and make it high on the list of things.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me first thank Senator Morsett for those words. And as I said, I don't doubt the good heart and the goodwill of every member of the committee. If the chairman's vision is that this bill needs to be held for a while till the situation clarifies in ways and means, that's his judgment, and I trust his judgment. I think it should go there at some point in time, and one of the things that we run into is out of sight, out of mind. You know? And a lot of us sometimes feel that way when it's a 6-hour drive to get here. You know, the further away we are, the little, you know, we're out of mind for the folks that make decisions here. But I also would just say that several years ago, probably on almost a decade now, we heard from an environmental organization that basically said that the trending in the West was moved to larger cities, and get on the major corridors for transportation, because your economies in the rural communities will follow the curve, and they will falter. And I, you know, we called it the mover starve doctrine that was being presented and pushed by the Wilderness Society. And most of us, when upon hearing that, resented that so thoroughly that we resolved that that wasn't going to be the future of rural Oregon. And essentially, we've come to the conclusion over the years that it's us in this building who are going to decide the future of rural Oregon, whether in fact we have sustainable communities in rural Oregon, or we just let circumstances roll out so that those that didn't move will starve. We are at ground zero for unemployment and less than zero in some of our communities. And I think this legislature probably is going to have to restructure the way we do business. And part of the argument that I hope we engage in is whether or not we're going to have sustainable rural communities. I don't want to see my community starve, and the citizens that live there don't want to move, and there ought to be a better choice than either move or starve. You know, there should be a choice to stay and grow and be sustained. So that's the challenge for anybody that represents rural Eastern Oregon and any rural community, I think, in the West right now.
Well, I don't want to be misunderstood by holding off the work session on this from that standpoint. And I'm certainly not saying that you shouldn't help me as I work with Senator Winters and Senator Schrader to advance this bill, because I will be doing that, and any help that you folks can give me on that would be much appreciated. And the situation is, I guess, that I feel some responsibility for doing my part in a tough time to try to make our situation here as smooth and as workable as possible. And so
Mr. Chairman, in one of my first and most enjoyable privileges upon election to the Senate was to be invited to go on a cattle drive in Grant County. And I learned a valuable lesson in this cattle drive. It's not so much that you have to push the cows, but sometimes you have to hold them back. And I think that's the unenviable position the chairman finds himself in. There's plenty of bills here that want to get down to Ways and Means, and your job's kind of try to hold them back a little bit. But I think this bill has a future, and I hope it gets down to Ways and Means for consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else that did not get a chance to sign up that would like to testify or give input here? Seeing none, I guess we'll be adjourned.
Yes. Now, if